another serial killer from Santa Cruz, Herb Mullin, grew up hating John Wayne, actually.
I wouldn't blame him. I was in a jail cell right next to him for months, and I was in prison up in the hole here in the lockup unit for going on 3 years with him, about two and a half years. And at one point, I got him a job in the kitchen. I was already on the kitchen crew, and a sergeant pulled me aside and asked me to talk to the guys about him coming on the crew, because he'd alienated a lot of the guys, and they were afraid there'd be violence. So I talked to them, and there was no problem, so they brought him out to the crew. He worked a few months, and he goes to the main line. I'm still sitting in the hole saying, geez, what happened here? And, you know, I knew Herbie, and I don't call him Herbert Mullin. And of course, I don't call myself Edmund Amo Kemper III either. I never heard that in my life until I was locked up for murder, right? But little Herbie was, when I met him in Redwood City Jail, okay, our first meeting was I bumped him out of the priority cell where they could look from the office and see through the steel door, the glass in the door, and see him physically, or they could watch the monitor and watch him. He got bumped next door. There was a shower in the priority cell. Never had to leave the cell. For him to shower from the other cell, he had to go out into the main area. They had to lock everybody in one of the, I guess you call them tanks. They moved 15 guys, 30 guys out of the tank into the activity area. They'd walk him around into their tank. He'd shower. He'd come back out. And all the way over there and all the way back, they're catcalling him. They're calling him names. They're yelling because he caused them great interruption in their day, right? He resented that. He got bumped out of the priority cell into a non-shower cell. I got the shower cell, right? So he wasn't too friendly at first. And I'd say, excuse me, Mr. Mullin, I says, do you have a bar of soap? There's no soap over here. He took it all with him. He had no need for it, but he took it with him. And he'd say, yes. And I'd say, well, can I use a bar of it? He said, no. And I'd say, well, I got one of these little shits here. And what it is, he's a little wimpy guy that hates big guys because he always feels intimidated by them, right? And that's how we started out. So I started thinking about that, and I went back to my old relationships in therapy and group therapy and Tascadero and youth authority and stuff, and I'm saying, okay, well, we can deal with this. So I said, well, I have to be kind to him. So I found out something he liked. He loved Planters peanuts, little bags of peanuts. Shelled peanuts, and so I bought 20, 30 bags of them. I didn't care for them myself. And I offered him some one day, and they were both on camera 24 hours a day. So I said, Herbie, would you like some peanuts? And he'd say, yeah. And I said, oh, I got to him, right down to the inner core there. Yeah, this little childhood thing comes out. And I says, oh, here. And he was fascinated by this thought of, gee, he's just giving me some peanuts, and I didn't do anything for him. I don't know him. You know, not being nice to him, why would he give me some peanuts? So he comes over to the bars. We can't even see each other, and I reach out with these peanuts around the side, and I see this little hand come out. And I thought of it almost as a little monkey paw. That's what it seemed like. So innocent, and this little hand comes out, starts to reach for the peanuts, and then he hesitated. Then he pulls back, and I thought, oh, geez, he's defensive. He's thinking I'm going to grab his hand and rip his arm off or something. I'm this great big guy, right? So without saying anything, I just reached around and I laid him on the bars and then pulled my hand away. And he took them and he enjoyed them and all of that. And I'd say later, I'd say, gee, Herbie, did you eat all those peanuts? And he'd say, oh, no, I still got some left. I said, well, I got plenty more. I says, go ahead and enjoy them. So what I did is I started giving him bags of peanuts. And he had this horrible habit. There's guys back in the tank, and he and I are in these cells facing them through three sets of bars. And I can't see him, and he can't see me. I don't know where on the set of bars he is. The set of bars is maybe 9 feet wide and, you know, 8 or 9 feet high. And when he would get to acting up, he'd sit there for hours writing and writing at this little desk. And the other guys were ignoring him. So that night they're watching Saturday Night Special, you know, with all this rock music playing and stuff, and they're enjoying it. And he'd get up and make this real loud speech about how bad television is for you and why you shouldn't watch it. All the things it'll do to you. And they're having fits. They're trying to throw things at him. They can't get at him. They're raging. They're mad because he's destroying the one thing they really enjoy. And he's just having a ball doing this. He'll sit for hours all day writing this two-hour speech, exactly as long as it takes to watch that show. So he'd also sit over there and sing these horrible songs. He couldn't sing a lick at all. And he's singing these horrible songs. And one time I was in the car coming back to Redwood City, and the cop got so upset at the singing he's doing in the back of the station wagon, he turns around with his can of mace. He says, "I've had it. Get out of the way, Kemper." And I'm saying, "Hey, wait a minute. You're going to get me with that stuff." And he's trying to mace the guy in the back of the car because he won't shut up. And he's trying to get him to shut up. And the guy just ignored him. He had this way of really getting in people's nerves. So he'd pull these little stunts, these horrible songs and the speeches and things. And I'd say, "Herbie, why do you do stuff like that?" He says, "Oh, I have a right to do what I want to do too." And yeah, okay, right. So I started this, what they call just real basic behavior modification therapy. Okay, I'd had a little bit of psychology study. I'd worked in the psych testing area in Atascadero. I knew some of these things. So I set up a very basic and very essential, just bare minimum behavior mod experiment, behavior modification, right? You reward them when they're good, you punish them when they're bad. And if you're absolutely accurate in when you do these things, quick punishment when they do bad and quick reward when they do good, supposedly this is supposed to attack you at a subliminal level, a subconscious level, and you don't have a lot of control over your reactions, that it would improve your behavior essentially. And then they have these great elaborate experiments, like in Youth Authority when I went through, where they try these things. So what I did is, when he was bad, I'd get a cup full of water in a styrofoam cup, and I'd reach around and I'd throw it on him. And it's embarrassing, and it also gets his papers wet, and you know. So we got this cat and mouse game. When he was good, I'd give him peanuts, and I'd try to gas him when he was bad. It's called gassing. Throw this water on him. And he'd duck all over the house. I couldn't figure out where he was at, so I kept missing him. So what I did is I waited one day till I knew he was asleep, or I suspected he was, and I called one of the guys over to the bars from the place in the back, the tank. And I went like this. I went, and I says, and he reads it, and he says, and I says, "Shh." And I call him over to the bars, and I said, "Hey, I said, I want to work something out where I can get Herbie with these cups of water and he can't figure out how I'm doing it." And I says, "I just thought of a way." And he says, "What's that?" And I said, "I want you to set up a grid on the bars where you're at. Put a little piece of string or a little piece of plastic or a little something he won't notice. Count over how many bars there are on his cell, on his cell front. And from the wall, go over that far on your set and set up boundaries. And then when I give you a signal that will be a hand signal, very casually walk over. Don't look at me, just casually walk over and drape yourself on the bars where he's at, so I'll know. And if he's back away from the bars, go back that far and position yourself so it's a grid, it's targeting grid." So he would do this, and Herbie'd hear me turn the water on, or maybe I'd have some already set up, and I would reach through the bars and I'd blast him, and I got him every time. And he couldn't figure out how all of a sudden I got so accurate, you know? And it was without fail. I'd get him with that water, wham. And, you know, it's embarrassing, and everybody's laughing back there, and good shot, Ed, and all that stuff. And then I'd ask him if he'd do something, or, "Hey, can we do this," or whatever, you know, and he'd participate in something with me. I'd give him peanuts. When he's bad, he gets blasted with water. This went on for 2 or 3 weeks. And he actually got away from the bad behavior when he said, "Hey, I want to sing." And I says, "Well, hey, guy's in the back. Do you mind if he sings?" "Oh, we don't want to hear that shit, man." I said, "Hey, you want to hear it now, or do you want to hear it tonight when you're watching the show?" "Yeah, okay, so... go ahead, Herbie, sing."
What did you sing?
And he'd sing for 30, 40 seconds, and then get bored and say, "Gee, I don't want to do this anymore." You know, because the fun was gone out of it. But the point is, it got a handle on his behavior. And the cops are watching this. The deputies are on camera watching me. I mean, they're on the monitors watching every move I'm making, right? And they're fascinated. They're watching this thing going back and forth with me and Herbie. They're not involving themselves. They're just watching it. And after a while, one of them came in and said, "Herbie is completely cooperative now. He's not messing around." Because I'd been, as we're talking, these little frictions out between he and I, I'm showing him some insights into why people don't like him. I'm showing some insights into what his behavior is causing in them. And he had realized by that point that it was just, he's reacting to how people are reacting to him. And it's just a self-perpetuating thing. And it was the only way he could get out his negative feelings. And I said, "Well, why don't you pose on the positive? Focus on the positive."
Because you mentioned in your writing about Satan, that these evil forces.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about Satan, what are you actually referring to?
Well, you know, many people may not really understand that, but at there was a time I was so confused and so troubled that... I was seeking meaning and purpose. I was seeking something, I don't know, as my life began to spin out of control, I mean, I got involved in like Satanism, and I was reading the Satanic Bible, and it was such a dark and troubled time, I'm just even ashamed to talk about it. And I think, you know, years later, I look back in hindsight, and I say to myself, you know, I don't even understand how I got involved in this. I don't even understand what the lure of the attraction was. I don't even know what I was looking for. But, you know, at the time, it's just like one thing after another. Once you go down the wrong path, you know, you just end up anywhere. So, you know, here I am. 30 years later, we meet in a prison.
So how's it feel to be here for 30 years, knowing that this is going to be it?
You know, it's like, you know, the expression, take one day at a time. And it's never easy, you know, being incarcerated. I have no one to blame but myself. But I realize, too, because of the seriousness of my offenses, that I'll probably never be released. But yet, you know, through my faith in Christ, I live with hope. I live with, you know, encouragement. There's so much to do. Dan, today I see myself almost like a missionary, you know, here. Like, in other words, missionaries go to, like, you know, foreign lands and share their faith with other people. I'm kind of like a missionary right here behind these prison walls. So I thank God for each day, and I'm managing.
Now, if you were able to get out, would you be a missionary? Would you go on to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
No, I would definitely not be a psychologist or psychiatrist. No, but I would be just a man who, with love and passion in his heart, would do everything I possibly can to reach young people. If things were different, and let's say I were getting out tomorrow and can start a whole new life with my friends on the outside who were involved in churches and so forth, youth ministries, I would go to like different schools, youth detention centers, wherever, to talk with young people. You know, try to just give them some words of encouragement, words of advice to just keep them on a good track, you know.
Now, you have a very large following, because it was interesting, because I was reading your looking at the website, mm-hmm. and I mean, you were interviewed by Larry King. You were interviewed,
yeah.
And you have communications with a number of Christian organizations.
Really, very small. It's not a large following. I have maybe 15 or 20, you know, good solid friends, and some I see who live in this area I could see on a regular basis, and others that are far away we only correspond by mail. But I'd say I have about 15 or 20 close friends, and that's about it, you know. But other people can view the site and, you know, get whatever they can from that, you know.
When I wrote to you a couple of months ago, and you mentioned that there were missionaries that came who were visiting here, or they were going out to Europe?
A friend from Russia, actually, yeah. He's with an organization called Russian Christian Radio, and actually he's from the United States, but he and his wife and family, they are living in Moscow right now, where they run the ministry from there. So it's interesting how, you know, people from all walks of life. I'm not Russian descent, but I have friends in Africa, and, you know, people I write to, Russia, different places, and, you know, they're all devout Christians, and we have a lot in common.
You're writing, because I mean, you happen to be a very good writer.
Well, okay, well, thank
you. I told you that once before. I've told you that on several occasions.
Okay, well, thank you.
And thank you. So how did your book, Son of Hope, how did that come about?
Well, actually, certain friends over time encouraged me to keep a spiritual journal. And I wasn't too keen on that one way or the other. I said, well, that's an idea. Well, they said they liked the way I write my letters and so forth, and they thought it would be a good idea if I were to write, you know, my day-to-day experiences as a Christian living behind prison walls, if I would just, like, kind of keep a journal.
All right, sir, let's turn to count 8. In count 8, it is claimed that on or about the 27th day of April 1985 to the 28th day of April 1985 in Sedgwick County, Kansas, it is claimed that you unlawfully killed a human being, Marine Hedge, maliciously, willfully, deliberately, and with premeditation by strangulation, inflicting injuries from which Maureen Hedge did die on April 27, 1985. Can you tell me what occurred on that day?
Well, actually, kind of like the others, she was chosen. I went through the different phases, stalking phase, and since she lived down the street from me, I could watch the coming going quite easily. On that particular date, I had another commitment, came back from that commitment, parked my car over at Woodlawn and 21st Street at Bowling Alley there at that time. Before that, I dressed until I had some other clothes on, changed clothes. I went to the bowling alley, went in there under the pretense of bowling, called a taxi, had a taxi take me out to Park City. I had my kit with me as a bowling bag.
All right, that was Park City in Sedgwick County,
yes,
Kansas?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. All right, you had the taxi take you to Park City. What happened then?
There I asked, I pretended that I was a little drunk. I just took some beer and washed it around my mouth, and the guy could probably smell the alcohol on me. I asked, told him to let me out so I could get some fresh air, and I walked from where the taxi let me off over to her house.
All right, where does she live?
6254? North Independence.
All right, when you walked over there, what happened next?
Well, as before, I was going to have sexual fantasies, so I brought my hip kit, and lo and behold, her car was there. I thought, gee, she's not supposed to be home. So I very carefully snuck into the house, kind of like a cat burglar, and after checking the house, she wasn't there. So about that time, the doors rattled, so I went back to one of the bedrooms and hid back there in one of the bedrooms. She came in with a male visitor. They were there for maybe an hour or so. He left. I waited till wee hours in the morning and then proceeded to sneak into her bedroom and flip the lights on real quick, like, or I think the bathroom lights. I didn't want to flip her lights on, and she screamed, and I jumped on the bed and strangled her manually.
All right. Now, were you wearing any kind of disguise or mask at this time?
No.
You indicated this woman lived down the street from you. Did she know you?
Casually, we'd walk by and wave. She liked to work in her yard as well as I liked to work. It's just a neighborly type thing. It wasn't anything personal. I mean, just a neighbor.
All right, so she was in her bed when you turned on the lights in the bathroom?
Yeah, the bathroom. Yeah, so I could get some light in there.
All right, what did you do then?
Well, I manually strangled her when she started to scream.
So you used your hands?
Yes, sir.
And you strangled her? Did she die?
Yes.
All right, what did you do then?
After that, since I was in the sexual fantasy, I went ahead and stripped her, and probably went ahead and, I'm not sure if I tied her up at that point in time, but anyway, she was nude. I put her on a blanket, went through her purse, some personal items in the house, figured out how I was going to get her out of there. Eventually moved her to the trunk of the car. Took the car over to Christ Lutheran Church. This is with the older church. And took some pictures of her.
All right. You took some photographs of her. What kind of camera did you use?
Poor Lord.
Did you keep those photographs?
Yes. The police probably have them.
All right. What happened then?
That was it. She was already dead, so I took pictures of her in different forms of bondage, and that's probably what got me in trouble with the bondage thing. So anyway, that's probably the main thing. But anyway, after that, I moved her back out to the car, and then we went east on 53rd.
All right, what occurred then?
Sir?
What happened then?
Oh, trying to find a place to hide her, hide the body.
Did you find a place?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Where?
Couldn't tell you without looking at a map, but it was on 53rd, Queen Greenwich, maybe. Maybe, what's the other one, Queen Greenwich?
Rock.
Webb. I think between Webb and Greenwich, I found a ditch, a low place on the north side of the road, and hit her there.
All right, you say you hit her there?
Well, there were some trees, some brush. and I laid that over the top of her body.
All right, so you removed the body from the car, put her in the ditch, and then laid some brush over the body.
Yes, sir.
All right.